Hello, listeners, and welcome to Sportspiel, the podcast that is as iconic and loved as much as West Bromwich Albion's new mascot, Boilerman. Joining me, Alistair Hooper, as ever to discuss all things sport, is Mr. Will Moulton.
I hope that was a genuine comment about Boilerman.
Did you see Boilerman?
You've got to love Boilerman.
Oh, that was absolutely wonderful.
Could be a woman, though.
And oh, let's not go down that road, shall we?
Happy Saturday morning.
Yeah, so for people who didn't see Boilerman, how would you describe him?
Just a very, very strange mascot that sort of looks like a boiler, but doesn't really.
And was clearly put together on a tight budget, I feel.
Yeah.
It's basically a cardboard box with limbs after West Brom signed a sponsorship deal with Ideal Boilers. And who says commercialism has taken over football?
I think West Brom might be struggling just a little bit.
You think?
Just a tad.
Well, speaking of Ideal, let's move on to the idyllic range of conversation that we have for you on today's show.
Oh, God.
Today, myself and Will will take a look back at the football transfer window as the big bucks were thrown around once again, while also explaining how the big spending attitudes are impacting on youth players. Following that, we will then discuss the Hockey World Cup that took place in Stratford and is essentially why we took a mini break. That competition saw a magical run from Ireland, as well as the Netherlands, coming out as champions. On this week's feature interview section, Will brings you an in-depth conversation with Great British wheelchair basketball star Amy Conroy. All that and more on this episode of Sportspiel. We begin with transfers and football. It's that time of year where gargantuan sizes of money get thrown back and forth as clubs try to build up their squads ahead of the new season. The transfer deadline in England closed on Thursday, August 9th, and in the Premier League in particular, the spending once again reached high levels. According to Nick Harris of Sporting Intelligence, the total spend of teams in the Premier League this summer reached £1.2 billion. The net spend was £877.9 million. The biggest spenders were Liverpool, with a net spend of £155.4 million. Chelsea was second at £87.3 million net. Newly promoted Fulham were third, after they spent £98 million even net. And fourth were West Ham, with a net spend of £82.3 million. The only team not to spend any money and purchase a player was Tottenham. So, what do we make of the cash splashing, considering both your favourite team, Liverpool, and my team, West Ham, are in the top four of biggest spenders?
Well, if you think about it, Liverpool still had 75, 80 million left over from the sale of Coutinho. So the net spend, actually, if you take that into consideration, wasn't too bad. It was still in the 70s, 80 millions, but they needed those players. They needed a goalkeeper. They needed someone to come in and fill the voids left by Coutinho. And then they brought in a couple of other good players. Fabinho as well, someone to help shore up the defence. And Jordan Shaqiri for £13 million. If he performs like he has been in pre-season, then that's going to be an absolute bargain. So I think Liverpool, to be seen as proper title contenders, they needed to shore up their defence. They needed to shore up their goalkeeper and maybe add one or two more attacking options for if Salah, Firmino, Mane don't fire or are injured. So I think they needed to spend that money. It's just a shame that they couldn't find any English players, but hopefully, you know, that Sturridge coming back as well, he looks like he's in red hot form. And then
Until he gets injured again,
but then a couple of young players like Ben Woodburn have gone off on loan this year, so hopefully they'll come back next year and be pushing for places. So hopefully it'll all be good for Liverpool.
So you say they needed to spend that money. Are you now optimistic ahead of the season start?
I think Liverpool fans should be massively disappointed if they don't mount a realistic title challenge. They really should be. With the money they've spent, with the team they've now got, you look at that team and you think there are some proper high quality players in there now. If they're not challenging for trophies in the Premier League, then it's a failure of a season, really.
Turning to my club, I suppose, and it's along the same sort of lines. Think of the protests that were going on last season at the Two Davids, Golden Sullivan, the owners of West Ham, for not spending money. And they've definitely spent some cash this summer in being fourth on the league table, and we've brought in nearly an entire new team's worth of players. But like you said, hardly any of them are British.
But the most interesting thing about West Ham is that two of, for me, the most exciting signings were free transfers.
Jack Wilshere.
And Ryan Fredericks, who did really well for Fulham last year and, mm-hmm. you know, could quite easily have gone for many millions of pounds if his contract hadn't run out. So two young-ish English players on a free there, that they could be your best deals of the summer.
Quite possibly, so long as Jack Wilshere stays fit. Same issue as Daniel Sturridge, really.
Yeah.
But then you look at, say, the 40-odd million we spent on Felipe Anderson and then Andre Yarmolenko, who was probably at his peak about 2 or 3 years ago.
He's still a good player. Still a very good player.
Still, from my point of view, considering some of the signings I have seen in my time as a West Ham fan, Savio Insarenko springs to mind. What a tragic case that
Manuel
was.
Manuel da Costa also springs to mind.
There's a few of those.
Julian Faber.
I could reel off a very long list. But as excited as I am, and I'm probably more excited about this season than I have been in a long while, probably since Dimitri Payet rocked up. But part of me is also, I like seeing players come through the youth system, because that's always been an integral part of West Ham. You look at the likes of Joe Cole, Rio Ferdinand, Frank Lampard, etc., etc. They all came through our youth system and cemented their places in the first team. And it's been quite a while. Mark Noble, really, was the last one that did it. And I was always of the opinion that we had one of the best bunches of young central defenders coming through at our club in Reece Burke, Reece Oxford, and Declan Rice more recently. Reece Burke was sold to Hull in this window, and I don't see Reece Oxford having much of a part to play this season. He could still go out on loan as well, realistically. Declan Rice, I expect him to make the odd fleeting appearance, but not really being a starter. And that's what disappoints me, because I can see so much potential in Oxford and Rice, and I would really love them to make the step up. But we've also just brought in Issa Diop, who was the record transfer signing at the time when we signed him from France. So I can't see those two getting beyond him, for example.
I think it depends what system Pellegrini plays. If he maybe goes for three centre-backs, then I don't see a reason why Declan Rice or Reece Oxford couldn't be in there given the other side or the other players you've got in that position.
But then I've obviously got the West Ham perspective here. But this is league-wide, and there's always a statement of why, I suppose, the national team, quality-wise, aren't in as much as a healthy position as they were several years ago, because people look at the high transfers and all these big players coming in from abroad, and does that block youth players coming through and making their name?
This is a discussion we had this time last year when the under-17s, 18s, 19s, 20s, 21s were winning trophies left, right and centre.
And we said at the time it'd be interesting to see what they do.
There is so much talent. And it's interesting that in pre-season, Chelsea, who are notorious for not giving their talent a chance, they did play quite a lot of the young players. And Arsenal played quite a lot of young players in pre-season, as did Spurs. So it'd be interesting to see, you know, those three, well, Arsenal aside, but Chelsea and Spurs didn't make that many big signings during the window. So there are spaces there for the young players to come through.
Chelsea side, I look at Ruben Loftus-Cheek, who was part of the England squad in the summer for the World Cup. If you're him and you've spent your entire season on loan at Crystal Palace, done well, and then come back and then your team signed Jorginho in the exact same position as you, how does that make you feel?
And you've also got Ross Barkley as well, a similar-ish player.
Danny Drinkwater.
He's more defensively minded, but yeah, another. Mm-hmm. It must make you feel rubbish.
But then,
but it also must spur you on, mm-hmm. to want to be better than them.
Exactly. But then I look at Tottenham, and everyone's criticising them for not actually spending any money and not buying a player. But then look at that youth academy. They've got a lot of serious talent coming through. Marcus Edwards, for example, is a name that keeps getting mentioned in terms of like next big thing to come out of that youth academy. And look at all of Tottenham's main players, really. Harry Kane, Dele Alli, yes, they bought him from MK Dons, but as a youngster, he's come through. Is their transfer style, i.e. not going and splashing the cash, actually beneficial in the long run? Because you get these youth players who've been part of that team for a while now in training, can actually step up and do a job. Harry Winks-esque, for example.
Well, there's another 17-year-old, I can't remember his name, but he's being likened as being the next Harry Winks, but better. And he's 17 and he played quite a lot in pre-season. So there are some good players in that academy system. And I think for English football, it could be really beneficial that Tottenham haven't spent, but for Tottenham it might not be so. It's difficult to tell. At this point in time, it's a guessing game, really. We've one game into the season as we record, which was last night, Friday night. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see.
We will see.
It is ridiculous, though, that Fulham on transfer deadline day were spending, you know, a newly promoted club who, when they went down a few years ago, were having financial troubles, can spend £30 million on a player that has, what, one international appearance? Whose name I can't pronounce, I'm not even going to try it. But the guy they signed on transfer deadline day, and, you know, spending however many millions on Jean-Michel Seri. And, you know,
like I said, they're third on the league table of net spend.
And then Wolves basically buying Portugal. It is, and they're newly promoted teams. They shouldn't be doing that.
You wouldn't imagine them to be in that position. So move on to sort of the next part of this topic of conversation, which again sticks with the youth players. Why is it that youth players seem to find it so difficult now to actually break into first team sides? Is it because of that whole transfer window thing? Or is it perhaps because of focus, financial distractions, which comes into the second part of our conversation, after the former Manchester United and Sheffield United striker Danny Webber, he was on Five Live on transfer deadline day, I believe it was, and he said that young players should only have access to 20 to 30% of what they earn until they get older, with the rest of that held in a trust managed by the league or by the Professional Footballers Association. He said, there are many young lads out there earning big money who are just blowing it. I'm watching a lot of players who earn money very early and have got a different idea of what it is to be a footballer. The PFA after that said that they are currently actively pursuing the idea of a mandatory savings scheme. But I'm inclined to go along with that line of thinking, and actually it seems to me to be quite a good idea for a young player to only have access to a certain amount of their salary.
Well, Danny Webber has said what other pundits have said before. I remember Jermaine Junior saying it, that there are certain young players now who are getting paid the big bucks and they lose their focus, they lose the drive, and ultimately they don't make it in the end. The players that we do see, you know, the likes of the Harry Winkses, they're the players that, for them, clearly money doesn't matter that much, and it's actually the football that matters to them, and that's why they've made it. But there are some players, and I'm going to bring Dominic Solanke into this because he caused trouble at Chelsea, because he wasn't a first-team player, and he was saying, I'm going to leave unless you pay me 50 grand a week. Like, that's unreal money for a 19-year-old, as he was at the time. And he's moved to Liverpool, and he's working hard, and he's doing okay now, but so many youngsters that clearly they're getting paid so much money, and they're going to go out and spend it. And, you know, if you've got that money, go out and spend it. But also, I think it surely must detract from their training, from their passion for the game. And I think to have this savings scheme come in is important, not just for that, but also for later on in life. We hear of so many footballers going bankrupt, you know, ending up homeless because of they're not managing their money.
Look at Kenny Sampson right now.
Exactly. And you need that education early on in how to look after your money, how to spend it. So I think, in principle, I think this is a fantastic idea.
Exactly, because I see so many issues with having that amount of money that early on. Firstly, there's the focus aspect. I think it detracts you from the main aim of your profession, which is to play football rather than to make as much money as possible. Nice bonus if you can do it, but football should really come first and foremost. There's the parting aspect, which again comes into loss of focus, and I didn't know how to manage money at the age of 16, 17, 18.
I was going to say, like, think back to when we were 18 years old. We weren't in a job, but if we'd been paid that sort of money,
think what you could do with that.
Exactly.
The fun you can have.
You wouldn't be thinking about your future. You just want to go and blow it and, you know, have a good time.
Exactly. So I don't blame them for actually thinking that way, because it's just what any normal 17, 18-year-old would do. But then there's another side to that, in that when you do get that amount of money, bearing in mind, I think by and large we can all agree some footballers come from a generally poor background.
Well, Romelu Lukaku,
prime example.
For example.
Raheem Sterling, you can say, in this country as well. Suddenly everyone who you're friends with really wants to be your friend. And then you get a whole load of other people, I'm sure, that will grapple on because you're the man in the money and you're where the fun happens. But at a moment's notice, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of those people who call themselves your friends suddenly stitch you up in one way or another because you've got money. And then that must do a whole lot to crush you, really, from a human standpoint, because we often forget about that human side of things.
Well, again, though, that just screams for the need for education, for people to be taught this and to be taught the risks that come with a great salary. But yeah, it's they're not normal 17, 18 year olds, are they? They're completely different, and they might want to lead a normal lifestyle, but they just need to be taught that, you know, they just need to be taught how to manage money, how to spot the signs of fake friendship and all that. And I think the clubs and the Premier League should be doing more of that. Whether they do or enough at the moment or not, I don't know. But I think if Danny Webber's saying, you know, they need to bring in this 20-30% maximum allowance and then put the rest into savings, I think if he's saying that as an ex-player, I think they should do it.
So then, considering what we've just talked about, do we put, when we're talking about young players breaking through into first teams, do we put too much of an emphasis onto things like the transfer market and maybe not enough emphasis on things like education and money management?
100%. Massively. There's so much focus on, oh, what big name are we going to buy this summer? How much money are we going to spend this summer? And it's actually, I'd rather it people being talked about, oh, look at this player we've got coming through. He played under 23s last year, did really well. We're going to break into the first team. Personally, I know I'd like that. Obviously, signing the big money players is great, you know, for Liverpool. Liverpool needed a goalkeeper. I would have liked Danny Ward, who's come up through the Wrexham and Liverpool academies. Obviously, he's now been sold, so they've gone and signed a big name player. Obviously, it would have been nice if a young English or homegrown player would have come through, but it wasn't going to be that case. But I think in the future, we really should be encouraging the youngsters and bringing them through. And this whole transfer window thing is just turned into a bit of a farce now. It's just who can outspend the other clubs, and it shouldn't be like that.
I think there's too much emphasis put on that. But then I always wonder, is the real, like, if you're a manager, aim is to win. And fundamentally, if you want to win, you want to play the best players who are in the best form. So why are, by and large, the English players not performing as well as someone you bring in from abroad? Is it that money management and that loss of focus that you maybe get from a lot of youth players? Is that kind of the real crux of the matter?
Or is it just the step up from under 23 level to first team level is just that much bigger?
Yeah.
And, you know, buying in those players who've been playing at a high level, maybe some another league, but the step up for them isn't going to be as big. I think they just need time to, you know, come through and develop. And unfortunately, they're not getting that. They don't, for various reasons, money, you know, and trophy cabinets being two of the main ones, they're not given that much time to blood. And Klopp tried to do it with Ben Woodburn a couple of seasons ago. Ben Woodburn didn't quite perform as everyone wanted him to, but Klopp gave him most of the season trying to bring him through. But then I think he got the pressure on his back, and we didn't see Ben Woodburn at all last year, and now he's gone off on loan. So it's, there's just, even managers with the best intentions, ultimately, football is a business. Money talks.
Exactly. I think I might have mentioned this before, but a while ago, and it was while I was in Scotland working as a football reporter, a long time ago now. But I remember doing a piece that the Scottish FA introduced. It was an initiative where you basically identify your talented players that could then go on to play for your country. And then they ended up signing agreements with a few schools around the country on the basis that this talented individual, boy or girl, probably around the age of 13, 14, would then get a place at that school, get their education, and then at that school they would place a Scottish FA coach there to give them training sessions in the evening at that school to try and marry that education with your football development as well. And I think it's very interesting to see how those kids, because it was a new initiative, actually turn out in the next couple of years when they do start reaching that level where they could start breaking through into youth teams and international youth teams as well, to see if that has actually worked. Because there's too many times, I think, where people get sucked into a youth academy, don't make it, and then get chucked back out into the real world. So it's interesting to see how that works out.
Yeah, obviously it will be, I think they'll have more of a chance in Scotland because it's not so money driven. But yeah, if that works and, you know, Scottish football starts, you know, getting better and clubs start becoming more competitive with the top two, then that sounds like a good scheme.
Yeah, hopefully. I think the slogan was all about creating better players but making better people first and foremost. So yeah,
I like that.
Better
like
players,
that mantra.
Better people. That was my headline. Topic two, which is the Hockey World Cup.
Whoop whoop.
And from July 21st to August the 5th, Stratford was at the centre of the hockey universe as Lee Valley played host to the 2018 Women's Hockey World Cup. 36 matches, 126 goals scored, and in the end, the Netherlands came out as winners. Now, I went on one day, a day where there was a yellow weather warning for thunderstorms, and it absolutely chucked it down, but thank you for those tickets. They were greatly appreciated. But you, on the other hand, were there every single day of the tournament.
I was.
So I suppose the big question for you, since you're best placed to answer this, is how will we look back on this event as a spectacle, but also in terms of cementing hockey as like a popular sport in this country?
So I've just, as we speak, a couple of hours ago, released a new piece for the 52, all
yes.
about the World Cup.
I haven't read it yet, but I will.
And I write in it, I believe that the 2018 Hockey Women's World Cup could be a breakthrough moment in terms of how, not just hockey, but how women's team sport is perceived in this country. I think it could have that much of an impact. Obviously, from the inside, you know, very internal, you don't notice these things, but then when you step away from it and you look at the coverage it was getting and the people talking about it, you know, the hashtag was trending. So many people jumping on the bandwagon, and not just English, but Irish, obviously, and from all over the world. But people people turned up. 120,000 tickets were sold. God, I sound like I'm actually just selling the tournament now. But 120,000 tickets were sold. You know, from what I'm told, some games on BT actually gained more audiences, more people watching them than some of their flagship men's football games, which is a massively impressive stat if that's true. And, you know, we had the BBC down there pretty much every day doing something of their coverage. We had stories on the BBC homepage. You know, people were talking about hockey, and not just hockey, women's hockey. People were taking an interest, and it was fantastic. It's just fantastic to see so many people getting behind women's sport. And I genuinely think, you know, that England hockey has now set a benchmark that other sports now need to follow, to if we're going to be serious and get women's sport on the same level as men's.
Speaking from personal experience, I think it was a great showcase for both hockey and women's sport, like you said. I mean, when the day I went, which is Friday night during the group stage, and the place was packed, other than the top tier of the stand, which barred everyone from sitting in it because of the lightning.
It wasn't earthed.
No. But like, I went with two of my mates who know nothing about hockey and had never watched it before in their lives, and we actually got properly into it. Not so much the first game, because that was a bit of a walkover. We saw Netherlands beat China 7-1.
But you also got to see the Dutch at their best.
Saw them at their very best.
How, you know, that's the level. That's how they are so good.
And can fully understand why they ended up winning the thing. But we also got very ingrained in the Italy-Korea match afterwards, where they won. They scored the winning goal with 5 seconds remaining. And we were actually gripped by that.
Definitely wasn't a legal goal, but anyway.
I didn't realise that. Thank you for informing me. But no, it was actually a good evening, despite the fact that we had to dodge rain for God knows how many hours. But I suppose that the overriding themes that I picked up from the tournament as a whole, firstly, England. Bearing in mind we are Rio gold medalists, and I think everyone was expecting a lot of big things from this team, how do you, bearing in mind you work for them, how do you assess their performance with them going out in the quarters to the team that did win it?
So it's interesting that you say that, you know, this is the team that won gold in Rio. Firstly, that was Great Britain, although they were all English players.
There were seven, am I right in saying?
Eight of the current squad of 30-odd are gold medalists, but only six were in action because two were injured. It's just we need to remember that this is an England side that is very different from that squad.
Because people
that won the European gold in 2015 and that formed the backbone of the GB side in 2016. It's a very different squad. We've got a lot of players aged 23 or under who are just beginning their careers. And, you know, they made mistakes. No one in that team was perfect throughout the entire tournament. But, you know, you need to have those learning curves. And there were glimpses from every single player that played throughout that tournament of something really good, really positive. They all could become world-class players. They just need time to develop. For example, we take Susie Petty, Catherine Lane, Ellie Rea, all aged 23, 24 or under. All got bags and bags of talent. Just now need just that more experience just to get used to the standard of international hockey because it's so different.
Is that the thing then? Is it about getting that out of the way and getting the stage fright aspect a little bit out of the way as well.
They're never going to play in a scenario quite like that again. 10,500 people cheering you on at home. You could definitely tell in the first game, certainly the nerves were there. They felt like the pressure was on. But that's natural. You know, most of these girls play in front of 40 people at a weekend, and that's the top level of English hockey. You get 40 people in the crowd watching you. So it's a completely new experience for them. And for example, Lainey, we've had her on the show. Before the Commonwealth Games, she had one international cap. She's still got about 12 in total. And that, you know, you then look at the players from the Dutch team, and that they're a different side to the one that lost the Rio final. But you look at their average age, it's 27, 28, 29. Players in there with 150, 175, 200 caps, and they're properly experienced team. They've been together non-stop for 2 years. They've had no real injuries. They're a very much a tight-knit crew. They're just, you know, they're where England will be in 4 years' time, I believe. If England stick with a very similar squad, keep developing together, England will be where the Dutch are in terms of a unit, in terms of, you know, the level of cohesiveness, their implicit understanding of where each other's going to be on the pitch at any one time. That's where England will be in 4 years' time. So I think, obviously, it was disappointing to go out of the quarterfinal stage, but there are so many young, really, really talented players here. And then you've got the likes of Alex Danson. I mean, Lily Owsley, you could say, is experienced, even though she's only 23. Laura Unsworth, Holly Pernweb, Maddie Hinch. A really experienced, switched-on core group of players who are going to help these youngsters come through. And I have every confidence going forward that, you know, maybe not at Tokyo, but after Tokyo, this is going to be a really, really strong England and Great Britain side.
On to more positive news, and I think away from the Dutch, the story of the tournament was Ireland and what they did in finishing runners-up. Granted, the final was a little bit one-sided, but considering where they were ranked and what they actually ended up achieving in that tournament, are they the team of the tournament, essentially?
Well, before we go on to Ireland, another thing that was so special about this tournament was that it was full of shocks, full of surprises. Okay, yes, the Dutch did run away with it, but other than that, you know, Spain were fantastic throughout.
Italy
won their first ever World Cup game. There hadn't been one since 1976 or something ridiculous like that.
That's the one I watched.
They were the lowest ranked team. No, they won two. You watched their second win. But, they pulled off surprises. The Spanish were fantastic throughout. Ireland's, and yeah, they were another level. It was, you knew that you just had a feeling surrounding them from that very first day against the US that there was just something very fairy tale like about them. And as soon as they got that opening win, you just thought, you know, they could spring a surprise here. Obviously, they then went on to beat India, guarantee themselves to be in the quarterfinals. Lost to England, which is always a positive. The fact that we know we can beat them. But we knew that anyway because we've beaten them in so many practice games recently. But there was just, and as I've written in the 52, it was very difficult each time Ireland played to pick out one standout performance because the entire team collectively performed so well. Obviously, you had the shootout heroes or heroines. So you had Aisha McFerrin, the goalkeeper, who was fantastic. You had Chloe Watkins, who was the hero of the shootout in the quarterfinals. You had Gillian Pinder, who was the hero of the shootout in the semifinals. You had Alison Meek, who did the most outrageous penalty shootout ever when she nutmegged the keeper. Really cheeky, but you know that everything they did turned to gold up until the final.
It turned to silver, but
it was brilliant. Everyone was watching them. To be in the stadium, 10,500 people, so many Irish flags, but to hear English people singing the Irish national anthem was genuinely, it gave me goosies, as they will forever now be known. Not goosebumps, goosies.
Goosies? What's the difference between a goosie and a goosebump?
It's just what the Australians call them.
Well, we've learned something but new
it was,
today.
It was unbelievable. So everyone wanted them to win apart from the Dutch. So, and it was also great for the tournament because it's not going to be remembered as the Dutch walkover. It's going to be remembered for what Ireland and Spain did. And it's also proven that, you know, you can have all the money in the world and you can have the best players in the world, but if they don't play as a team, and this is not aimed at Great Britain, or England and the Dutch, is more aimed at, you know, the Argentina and Germany, who didn't play as a team, were very much individuals, especially Argentina. But if you just play together as a team, you have that cohesiveness, you can go as far as you want. And now to see, you know, Mariah Carey and Conor McGregor tweeting about them, and to see that they've got an extra increase in funds of over €1 million, they've had They've jumped up 8 places in the world rankings. You know, they're almost qualified for their first ever Olympics. It's just a fairy tale, but it was brilliant. It was magical to watch.
And that's essentially the beauty of sport and why we love it.
Sport is special.
Sport is special. Hence why we do this.
Very much.
Final word, I suppose, goes to the Netherlands, the overall victors. Just how much of a class above everyone else is that team?
It's just the step up from club hockey to international hockey is one thing. Then there's a step up from playing international hockey to playing against the Dutch at the moment. They are that good. Australia did give them a very good run for their money in the semis, taking them to a shootout. But, you know, the Dutch arguably played their best hockey against England. So to have only lost 2-0, I think the English girls can really hold their heads up high. They put on a fantastic battling performance. And it was just two mistakes that cost the goals, you know. But the rest of the time, I thought we defended really well. But the Dutch, yeah, they're just brilliant. Lieder van Velten is just something else. She's just one of those players that has it all. She's quick, powerful. She makes every decision she makes is brilliant and perfect. Sense of timing as well. She's just fantastic. You've got Kitty van Marler up front, who scores goals for fun. Really, really talented striker. You've got Carly Andertske van der Hervel in defence. Just leads that team with aplomb. Although she did do herself a discredit by calling us headless chickens, which didn't go down very well, but she has apologised for that, so it's fine. And yeah, just the squad they've got, you know, Kelly Jonker, Eva de Herder, Margot van Heffen, Josine Koenig and Adam Feenendaal in goal, and then you've got Frederica Matler, Lorien Lurink and Laura Nunnink coming through, who are really exciting players. They're just so physical. They're just so much bigger, stronger, faster, more powerful, more technical than anyone else at the moment. And it's a genuine pleasure to watch them play. I watched the first game they played against Korea when they were 7-0 up in 18 minutes. And that was the best 18 minutes of hockey I've ever watched, because it was unbelievable what they did. Those 7 goals each was brilliant. And then when obviously they went on and beat Italy 12-1. That was something special as well. And they're just, at the moment, they're in another world.
Another hockey planet.
But England will be there in 4 years, so it's fine.
Well, we look forward to seeing that. And to bring to an end your practice of Dutch pronunciation, we will...
That was very good.
I was very impressed with that. We will draw the discussion section to a close on this episode, but stick around because, of course, it is feature interview time. And to introduce his guest, Amy Conroy, Will Moulton.
Indeed, Amy Conroy, what a bubbly, lovely personality she is, and she definitely comes across like that in her interview. So for those of you who don't know her, she is the most consistent Great British wheelchair basketball point scorer of a generation. She is heading off, well, she's actually out in Germany now with the squads. They're starting their World Championships in Berlin, so we preview that. She talks about, you know, being part of squads at Rio and London 2012. She talks about how much the sport is growing and how different it is to, you know, conventional basketball or basketball as we know it, and also, you know, the story of how she got into the sport in the first place, what she had to overcome, you know, osteosarcoma and losing her mum. And one thing I really like about the interview is the way she talks about her special bond with her dad. So plenty of heartwarming moments. It's a fantastic interview, really lovely personality, like I said, so make sure you stick around for that.
Have you signed up to Banana Crumble, the free online cash prize giveaway? Sign up today at www.bananacrumble.co.uk for your chance to win. Sign up is quick, free and easy. Don't believe us? Hear what some of our winners have had to say.
Winning £50 with Banana Crumble was an amazing feeling. Being a student, it's often hard to get money, so I was able to put it straight towards my rent for second term.
Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. Working alongside the Cystic Fibrosis Trust to raise vital funds for this fantastic cause.
So hello listeners, and welcome back to this episode of Sport Spiel, where today I'm delighted to say that we are welcoming an athlete from a completely brand new sport onto the show today, and we welcome on Amy Conroy from GB Wheelchair Basketball. Thank you for coming on, Amy, and yeah, great to have you here.
Of course, great to talk to you.
So we're speaking to you, we're previewing you, your tournament, your World Championships coming up. How are you and the rest of the squad feeling ahead of that?
We're feeling really good. We've got one more tournament, I think, before we fly out to the Worlds. We've got 2 or 3 sessions a day happening right now, and just pulling everything together before we go.
And how much
time are you spending training at the moment? Is it pretty much every day?
Yeah, Monday to Friday right now, every day. I think we have about 7 hours worth tomorrow. So by the end of the week, everything just aches. But it'll pay off.
And the sport of wheelchair basketball itself, it's very different to, you know, a basketball that a lot of us watch. Can you just explain sort of the main differences of the two games?
So the court and the height of the nets and all of the size of everything is all the same. Obviously, we play in chairs, so there's extra rules for contact, what you can and can't do, no double dribble. And I guess the dynamics of the game change tactics-wise because of the chairs, so it's more of a pick-and-roll type game than able-bodied, which is more ISO. I guess.
Is it quite a physical sport as well with the chairs? Is there quite a lot of chair banging?
Yeah, there is a lot of contact. I've just got my new Formax chair. It's amazing, but it's rapid, and I've changed like the wheel positioning, so it spins a lot, and I spend a lot of time today on the floor.
And you mentioned the chair there. Is it so? These chairs that you use are very, very different to sort of wheelchairs that we don't see either in the public domain or in other sports.
Yeah, they are. Everyone's like made to measure for their chair. The wheels are slanted more, called camber, so they can spin quicker, and we should technically fall out less. If you used an everyday chair on court, it would be pretty disastrous, I think.
So, for example, say if I was to go try one of your wheelchairs out, would I find it pretty almost impossible to control then?
When I first started, I was terrible trying to balance the chair and dribbling and everything else. So it does take some work.
And there is obviously a reason why you got into wheelchair basketball. And at the age of, I think it was 12, you were diagnosed with osteosarcoma, which sort of drastically changed your life. So I was wondering if you could just sort of talk us through about, you know, how you cope with that and the changes that you had to make and what the disease actually is.
Okay. So growing up till about the age of 12, I was really sporty. I was in most of my school sports teams, did a lot of dancing. I started getting this pain in my knee, went back and forth to the doctors a lot, and I think because of all the sport, they were saying, it's fine. It got really bad, and I took an emergency trip to A&E with my dad, and after x-rays found out that I had osteosarcoma, a tumour, bone cancer, and it spread pretty badly after a few places. I was given 50% chance of survival, and I just remember the diagnosis really clearly. I was there with my dad, and we just looked at each other, and my mum had passed away previously of cancer, and it was just that look I won't forget. We just thought, oh, okay, right. But after a year of pretty intensive treatment in hospital, I had a few days at home, but I did get really sick, and it was touch and go quite often. And then halfway through, my leg was amputated above the knee. And then, yeah, a year on from that, I was in remission, and I've been in remission ever since.
And you talked about there about having your leg amputated, and was that a decision that was made lightly, or was it just one of those that it just had to be done to save your life?
There was no other choice really. It spread pretty high up. An X-ray that showed my thigh bone. There was just nothing left of it. And my dad was amazing the entire year, and he has a great sense of humour. And I think goofing around with him just made everything easier. And I guess it's a big thing to have your leg amputated, but at the time it was just one of those things. And I've never looked back since. I don't think I'd change anything now. I've adapted, and I really love the way my life's turning out.
And you mentioned there before the diagnosis you were very sporty. Was it pretty much a case of as soon as you could, you were straight back into the action, trying out new things, different things?
It wasn't actually, no. Well, I was, as I mentioned, I was pretty sick when I was in hospital. The first day I counted, it was like 75 times. I was just like lying there in bed, and I was pretty weak after it. And as soon as I was out of hospital, it was just every little thing that I used to take for granted, just eating and drinking. I was just loving life. I remember the first time I went back to Tesco's with my dad, and I literally had the time of my life there. And my dad wanted me, I think, probably to get out of the house. Probably I was having too much fun in Tesco's, so I was a loser. And he took me to a taster session. And I wasn't a fan at first. I thought, well, when you first suggested it. I just thought it was going to be kind of, I don't know much about disability sport. I thought it was going to be kind of, you know, everyone come and have a try, and baskets going to be on the floor, and it's quite gentle. But once I got into it, I'm quite competitive, and I love the aggression of it. I guess when you're a sick kid, and you know, people see you, you've got bald hair, and you're in this big Red Cross wheelchair, they're kind of precious of you. And I loved how everyone was equal, and people went at you. And it just, ever since then, I haven't looked back and got really addicted to it.
And you've done pretty well from the sport since. So was that the first sport you tried out then, or were there others before then as well?
No, that was the first one. I was pretty weak when I first started. As I said, I was terrible. And then since then, I've tried more sports and got into different things. But this is the sport I love.
And you mentioned your dad there, and how, you know, he stuck with you through all the hard times, and he took you to the taster session. How important is that relationship, even, you know, going on now when you're in remission and you're an international athlete? Is it that you still got that really special bond with your dad?
We do. He's amazing. I think because it's just him and my sister and me. All these experiences have just brought us closer, and he's been there from day one when I first started, and he used to take me to this outside court, and there were all these guys there, and there was dog poo on the floor, and it was just each evening after work he'd take me there. And I think at the time he thought, God, she's hopeless, but he stuck with me. And so it's always special when I see him in the crowd or after a good game or something, because it does mean quite a bit to him, I think.
Of course. And now you're representing Great Britain internationally. At what point did you actually think, you know, actually I could really progress and really get far in this sport? Was there a specific moment at all?
I don't know, it all happened really quickly. I remember watching the girls play before and just thinking they were insane, and I wanted to get there. And the first few selections where I didn't make it, I think it was that being turned down that just made me want to go away and work harder. And it's taken over my life ever since, really, since that first selection.
And how much has the sport itself grown since you first started? You talked about, you know, the dog poo on the course and stuff like that. Is wheelchair sport, is that one that's, you know, progressing and getting better and better, and you're getting more people and better facilities?
Definitely. So that was just me by myself on this outdoor local park. And now we've Great Britain team centralised in Sheffield. And a massive thanks to UK Sport Lottery who fund us. The facilities are amazing. We have our own court now.
Is that something you then want to try and promote, you know, that actually it's not just certain disability sports you can go into, it's maybe the sort of lesser known ones like basketball? They've got great facilities and it's a great sport to come into.
Yeah, and we have clubs all across the country. Participation is increasing massively ever since the London 2012 Games. And I think even if you don't take it to a high level, if you have a disability and you start a sport, or even, you know, hang around with other people with a disability, it's given me so much confidence off court as well. I think at first I was the only person I knew with a disability, and I was a bit self-conscious, a bit embarrassed if anyone saw that I had one leg. And now I don't even think about it. So even if you don't want to play at a high level, sport can really change your life. I'd recommend it to anyone.
And I guess that there's so many players in the team with all their own remarkable stories of overcoming the odds. Is that something that really brings you together as well, that gives you a great unity, the fact that you've all come through all of this and come out the other side?
Definitely. I mean, in day-to-day, you kind of forget about all these things that we're focusing on. You know, we'll take little things really seriously, like big losses that we just get so frustrated and down about. And then when you step back from it, and you actually realise everyone's story and everyone, they are really inspirational girls, and we don't kind of say this cheesy stuff to each other. But when you put it all into perspective, I am really proud to play alongside them.
And you mentioned in a previous answer London 2012. Am I right in thinking you competed at those games?
Yes, London and Rio 2016.
And we'll start with London. How was it? You know, you were still a teenager competing in front of a home crowd.
It was amazing and kind of heartbreaking at the same time. We were a very young squad, mostly teenagers, I think. And it was amazing to play in front of friends and family, and the way the nation got behind Great Britain. I love patriotism. But also, we didn't place where we wanted to. We came seventh, and that was quite crushing at the time.
And then we move on to Rio 2016, where you placed a couple of places higher in fifth, but still not quite on the medal. Was that a similarly disappointing experience for you?
Yeah, we came fourth, so we lost in the bronze medal game. But ever since then, we've just picked ourselves back up, and we're really improving as a squad. So I'm really excited for the World Championships.
And competing at those Paralympic Games, I imagine you probably got the biggest crowd you've ever competed in front of. And how much of an impact does how that much support have on you guys? Does it really push you on?
Yeah, definitely. We did all these practice sessions with noise and things beforehand. But then when you get there, you realise that nothing really can prepare you for when you're actually there and the lights and cameras and everything. But I guess once you're playing and you're in the zone, you don't think about it at all. You don't even notice that they're there.
And you were also part of the under 25 squad that won gold, was it, in the World Championships in 2015? And how was that for you?
Yeah, that was amazing. It just shows that the youth of our team, and as we're all getting, the under 25 World Championships was amazing. We were undefeated. I co-captained with Laurie Williams, and it just felt like such a cohesive team. And I just thought, after that, I'm just so excited to play alongside these girls for the next 10 years.
And are quite a lot of this squad going forward into this tournament in next month?
Quite a lot of the girls from the... Yeah, I'm not sure what our average age is now, but I think our oldest player is 28, I think. So, I think we might still be one of the youngest squads. But now we're kind of not focusing on the youth and the energy line anymore, because we're all, I guess, veterans.
Going into this tournament, are there any sort of games in particular that we as fans should really be watching out for, that you play that will be really close encounters or really exciting matches?
There are so many good female teams now. It's really exciting how much the sport's progressing. I guess anything after the pool stages, once it gets to the quarter, semi and the finals, that's when things get heated and that's when the real excitement starts.
And are you, as a squad, thinking of where you'd like to finish, or is it just a case of a game-by-game process?
I mean, our coaches take it as game-by-game and staying humble and hungry throughout and just move on to each game. But, we want to medal.
And just final question from me. The tournament's coming up. Just one message from you. Why should we as fans watch you guys in action?
Energy of the game, it's fast, it's dynamic, there's so much going on that it's a sport worth watching.
And that's a perfect note to end on. Thank you so much for your time, Amy, and all the best.
Thank you very much.
Thanks once again to Amy for coming onto the show. Hope everyone, as always, enjoyed our feature interview section. And before we leave you, we'll fire off some last-minute messages. As always, you can follow us on social media. We are on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. All of our handles are SportSpielPod, and you can also email us feedback or whatever is on your mind. Our email address is SportSpielPod@gmail.com. That is it from us this week. Apologies you've had to wait so long for another episode, but I hope it was worth the wait. We will be back in 2 weeks' time, we think.
We hope.
Which is the 26th.
26th, 27th of August, that weekend. Bank holiday weekend.
Oh, is it?
Yes, it is.
Oh, I wonder if I got the Monday off. Probably not. Enjoy that bank holiday weekend, everyone. Until then, plenty of sport for everyone to get stuck into. Football's back. And although it never really left.
And if you really fancy it, so today, tomorrow as we record, but today the podcast comes out on Sunday, Alistair has a 4,500-word special coming out on his 24 hours with homeless people, so make sure you look out for that.
I didn't even ask you to plug that.
Doesn't need a plug, it just needs just read it.
Yeah, please do. I spent an entire 24 hours last weekend sleeping rough on the streets of Chelmsford in Essex with two rough sleepers. So it is
that alone deserves at least a read.
Thank you. It was deeply uncomfortable sleeping on concrete, and I saw a lot of things.
Many things.
It's in 4,500 word report form, but it's also in a podcast as well. So if you like podcasts, subscribe to Humans of Chelmsford and listen to that episode and boost my stats. That's it. in terms of personal plugging and sport discussion from this week. Until we next return, have fun, everyone. Bye-bye.